It is currently 7:09, and Dr. David Elias, an orthopedic surgeon with Ortho LA, nice enough to join us. Talk about Eric McCoy, and we all know by now that the reports he's undergone surgery for a groin injury. And to be clear, good morning, doctor. How are you?
Good morning. How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Thank you. To be clear, Dr. Elias knows nothing about Eric McCoy's condition. That's safe to say, accurate. You've not seen him or treated him or anything?
Yes, that very rare injury and extremely rare that it needs surgery. So it's, you know, I haven't seen the exact injury, the exact tendon that was injured, or the exact surgery plan, but I assume he tore his groin muscle probably from the pelvic bone, and probably reattaching the tendon back to the bone.
That hurts just to hear about it. Let's talk about a groin injury for people that don't know it, and I guess as much as you can over the radio, explain what muscles are involved, et cetera.
Well, there's probably four or five muscles that cross the hip area, the iliopsoas, the adductor. There's a few more, and typically someone gets a hip flexion injury, and they can either tear the tendon where it attaches to the bone or where it attaches to the muscle. Mm-hmm. Most of these injuries happen at where the tendon attaches to the muscle, and they're typically non-operative. You just like a hamstring, you let them heal, and they can linger for, you know, depending on the grade of the tear, they can linger for a while. I was surprised when I heard they were doing surgery. I assumed that he has this unique injury where it probably pulled off of the bone, and the quickest recovery and to get him back to full is to reattach the tendon back to the bone.
Generally speaking, again, not specifically when it comes to Eric McCoy, but generally speaking, to get back to the point of playing at that kind of level, the recovery is what?
I mean, I would tell my patients any tendon that I'm reattaching in the hip area, I would start the rehab process probably at around 3 months, and then it takes them a few weeks to kind of get back to the strength they need. But, you know, this could be a partial tear. Who knows exactly what they're doing? I read that they said 6 to 8 weeks, and, you know, rehabbing an NFL player is a lot different than rehabbing the, you know, everyday athlete. Mm-hmm. So, I think 6 to 8 weeks would be a home run if they got him back.
Scale of 1 to 10 on a pain scale, where is this?
Probably when he did it, probably close to a 10.
Hoo-wee. Thank you, doctor. Any final thoughts before we let you go? I know you're busy.
No, I look forward to seeing exactly what surgery they plan, and you know, hope that he's in month, you know, after 6 to 8 weeks, kind of getting back to play in shape.
And what's the rehab like on this? You start walking, then you start with some weight resistance training?
They'll probably have him on crutches for 2 to 4 weeks, but I imagine they'll start some passive range of motion in the hip immediately.
Okay. Thank you, doctor. Appreciate your time as always. Dr. David Elias, orthopedic surgeon with Ortho LA. We'll take a break. And then when we come back, we're going to do some stuff. 7:13, Tommy Tucker, WWL. All right, 7:17 now. Kevin Gilmore joins us with the National Weather Service to talk about Helene. Good morning, Kevin. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
First thing I can only think of is you don't want to wish anything bad on anybody else, but thank goodness that thing's not coming here.
Yeah, that's right. The latest with Helene is looks like it's going to be impacting the Florida Panhandle area here coming up in the next few days. Bad news for them, but for us here, looks like we're going to escape any type of direct impacts. So, again, that's some good news for us.
What about the storm itself, the intensification, and we hear so much about rapid intensification of the waters in the Gulf where it is now in the Gulf, right? Are they conducive to rapid intensification?
Very well could be. Very warm waters for this time of year. And it's currently in the far northwest Caribbean, but it's entering the southeast Gulf. Yeah. And it's moving up to the southeast Gulf. Very conducive for quick intensification. It's likely going to be a hurricane later today, if not probably this morning. Becoming a major hurricane, Category 3, possibly as it gets up towards the Florida area as we get in towards the day on Thursday.
How fast is it moving and how important is that?
It's moving right now, not that fast. It's northwest at 9 miles per hour, but it will be picking up pace as it gets towards the northeastern Gulf. It'll actually be moving at a pretty quick pace. That doesn't really change much in the way of impacts. It's still going to bring a lot of high winds, coastal flooding, surge, and even some tornadoes, too, on that east side. So not really much in the way of any type of change other than it'll be, you know, quick to hit, out of there fast, but still it'll come in with a strong punch.
Talk about the size of it, if you will, because they're saying and how do you determine the size of a storm? Do you determine that on rain bands or the winds that go out from it or the overall? I'm curious about that, Kevin.
Yeah, that's a good question. Really what we see is via a satellite imagery. It's got a really large circulation to it, very large in, as far as like this pressure gradient winds. It's a very large circulation. So a larger storm like that typically has impacts that extend a little bit further out from near the center of the storm. So hurricanes, they come in different shapes and sizes. This is just one of those that has a little bit bigger circulation given the atmospheric conditions, and impacts will be felt well far away from the center of the storm.
So that means who's going to be impacted by this? And are you talking rain, wind, storm surge? Because a lot of people have property in Florida that live here. A lot of people travel to Florida, have friends, et cetera. Tell me about that.
Yeah, absolutely. All the way from anywhere in the Florida panhandle, all the way even up towards the Atlantic East Coast of Georgia and South Carolina. Impacts will be felt well inland, too, north of Florida. And we're talking about Georgia. If you have families and friends up in Macon, Georgia, Atlanta, even getting up into the lower portions of the Appalachian Mountains, there'll be some impacts, too. Dangerous flooding rain, high wind conditions all up across the mid-Atlantic coast there, even getting into the Tennessee Valley. So this is what happens with these types of systems. When they come into the land like this and they go in a quick pace, all those impacts can spread inland and cause widespread power outages, flooding rains, all types of impacts as you get towards inland locations.
So when it comes to places like Disney World and all the way over to Pensacola, all of these places in Tampa Bay, all of these places could be experiencing effects from this?
Yeah, absolutely. Pretty much all of Florida is going to see some type of rain or some coastal flooding associated with it, just depending on where you are in correlation to the center of the storm. I will be feeling some impacts in some way or fashion. As you get towards Alabama and Mississippi, there's still going to be impacts, but it gets a little bit less. But still, that's going to be because of that little bit of a northerly flow offshore. But still, even for us here locally, we're going to have a lot of high waves and seas out in the Gulf waters. But for land impacts, nothing really for Louisiana. It's all going to be for Florida, Georgia, even portions of Alabama, and in the Carolinas are going to see some of the worst of it.
And the all clear has been sounded for us, correct? We're good on this?
Safe to say that model guidance is in very good agreement that it'll be pretty much what we're seeing from the National Hurricane Center. They have got a great forecast. The cone looks fantastic. It's looking like it's going to be heading in that path. No types of tricks, no types of any types of sways with the forecast. It's going to be heading towards that direction, not impacting Louisiana or Mississippi. If anything, our weather is going to be a lot nicer as we get towards the weekend, especially as we get towards that west side. That west side is typically the drier side, so we'll actually be seeing some more nicer weather conditions here.
The timing on this, you got Saints fans traveling to Atlanta. How much of a concern should that be for them if they're either driving or flying?
That would be a pretty big concern because even with the latest National Hurricane Center outlook showing that there's hurricane conditions possibly going as far north as central Georgia, that's going to be late Thursday into early Friday morning. So those traveling to Georgia or through Georgia into Alabama, South Carolina, that whole area definitely needs to check the latest conditions, check the forecast, make sure you know the road conditions. If there's any closures ahead of time, just be weather aware because there's a lot of impacts out in that area.
And what time frame would that be again, just to be clear, Kevin, if people are driving?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. That's going to be late Thursday getting into early Friday through that whole area, lasting possibly through around Friday afternoon. Again, it'll be moving at a quick pace, but still those impacts could linger for a while. Rain bands left over, even gusty winds could be possible late Thursday into Friday.
And I know you're with the National Weather Service, not the FAA, but if you're flying, a lot of times anything that has to do with Atlanta, even if you're not going to Atlanta, the Atlanta airport disruptions there can affect everything else. With the timing of the storm, If people are flying to Atlanta, I don't know, is there any way you can tell them what kind of concern they could have or should have?
Yeah, it's hard to say if there'll be any types of delays or cancellations. But definitely check with your airliner if you have any type of delays or cancellations ahead of time. Just depending on what time you're flying through, where the worst of the weather is at the time will have everything to do with that. If the storm is quicker or slower or it's out of there by the time you fly, maybe you'll be able to squeeze through it. But it's really hard to say right now. I would definitely check back for updates.
And I know you're busy, but I'm getting some texts about the Fujiwara effect. Could you talk about that, please, and the chances of that happening here?
Yeah. To say it in more in simpler terms, there's an upper-level low that's actually kind of interacting with the system. This upper-level low is going over across the Ark-La-Tex region or around Arkansas. It's helping to kind of, we call it kind of slingshot it one direction, kind of around it. As it pulls south, it's going to go north. So these two interacting with each other helps to kind of change the direction of the storm a little bit, and that's why it's going to be going towards Georgia and curving back to Tennessee and Kentucky, while that upper low actually follows the opposite motion of that towards like Mississippi and Alabama. So that upper low is largely responsible for the direction in which the storm is going. You can say it's kind of bad news for them, but good news for us. But that's kind of helping where drive the storm going where it's going.
All right. Thank you. So anything else we should worry about out in the Atlantic or anything?
Nothing really. Not in the next 7 days. I think we're looking pretty good here locally. Once we get rid of Helene and it goes inland as we get towards the weekend, again, nice weather conditions here. So let's focus on that. We've got really nice cool temperatures in the morning. We're talking about lows in the mid-60s, low dew points. It's going to make you feel real comfortable. So let's get out there and enjoy it.
And if you can give me the next 7 days all clear, that takes us in October, and that's a win. Thank you, Kevin.
Hey, thank you.
Appreciate your time and your insight. Kevin Gilmore, National Weather Service, 725, Traffic Now, WWL. 744, 16 till 8. Very valuable information from Kevin Gilmore, the National Weather Service. And again, you don't want to wish anything on anybody else, but I can only imagine the disruption that we would have here if something like Helene were to come barreling in, especially on the heels of Francine. With that, we welcome in Dub Lane, Walter Dub Lane, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at my alma mater, UNO. How you doing, Dub?
Hey, good morning, Tom. I'm fine.
Tell me about this dock worker strike. What's going on with this?
Well, again, this is a regional strike of the East Coast and Gulf Coast dock workers, which is a pretty big deal. The West Coast people have a different union. And they had one back in 2007. This hasn't happened for several decades. And it potentially could be very, very disruptive in many different ways. Because, I mean, if we just think back of what happened, during the COVID, mm-hmm. Because of COVID, things, the docks shut down out in Los Angeles and stuff, and then all of a sudden the supply chains across the country got messed up and people couldn't get supplies, they couldn't get materials, things of that sort. The docks, obviously, are where so much stuff comes in and out, and it's not just the immediate effect on the dock workers, but again, if they can't unload the steamships, then, the truckers don't need to have a job. And so there's lots of other things down the line. But the key thing is all those supplies that are either going into the country, out of the country, are going to be sitting in these ships or sitting on the docks waiting to be loaded and backing up. And once they start backing up, it takes for any day, the estimate is for any one day that the docks are shut down, these big container ships, it could take 5 days to fix the problem.
For most of us, we do the bypass on Chapultepec Street, or we go down and it's behind the wall and we don't know what's going on behind there. How busy is the port of New Orleans, and where does that stand when it comes to, I don't know how you even measure it, in terms of cargo or whatever with the union, in terms of percentage of either cargo handled or employees involved as it relates to this union and this potential strike that could happen on September 30th?
Well, the port of New Orleans directly affects about almost like 20,000 jobs, but the people that are going on strike is a very small percentage of that. Like up in Baton Rouge, it's only like 8 people for their port, mm-hmm. but in New Orleans, it's a much bigger one, particularly that big container port on Napoleon. Mm-hmm. That's a huge one, and again, so it affects you know, just it's a major driver of our local economy. You know, we also usually talk about it. It's not one of the top three or four, but it's very much on the list of one of the drivers of the economy. And if that thing starts shutting down, and what the key thing is not just what it affects us locally, is that the Port of New Orleans is, I think, well, it's the number one break bulk port in the United States, meaning all those grains and stuff that are growing up in Iowa and Minnesota that come down the Mississippi River and loaded onto ships for the rest of the world. That's our number one cargo. We do a lot of chemicals as well, petroleum, and then there's other things that come in and out of the port. But you know, if that grain all starts getting backed up, then we're not going to be able to ship that out. That's going to hurt the farmers all up the middle of the country. And the ports in the east, are going to affect the things that come in. Right now is when retailers are bringing their Christmas materials in. Uh-huh. And if that gets backed up, we might not have Christmas, or at least certainly diminished one.
You mean a dock workers' strike could cancel Christmas, Dub? Is that what you're telling me? Wow.
Well, obviously that's clearly an exaggeration.
Quite a shock to the young men and women going to school early. Kids, relax. Santa Claus has still come. Well, I don't want Dub to get you all freaked out or anything here, but it is important that they hammer. I'm just kidding you. That they hammer out an agreement. You know the.
Again, it is the case. If it was a strike that lasts, more than a week or two, then it really could mean that some of the things that the big Christmas items won't make it to the shelves. Not it's going to close Christmas, but
I know. I'm just kidding with you. I'm just tugging you.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Well, but when it comes to the nature, and I know you're not a shop steward or anything with the International Longshoremen's Association, but you look at and I like old movies because I studied film at UNO with Steve Hanks was his name, I think, if I remember correctly. You think of the movies with the guys with the on the waterfront with the hooks and the sacks and all of that. The nature of that work has changed greatly. It's all container now for the most part, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean these guys are running cranes and these big things mostly these days. There's not much hauling things on your shoulder anymore.
So I guess when it comes to the nature of the union agreement. Louisiana is a right to work state, but how the port agrees to do business with the union? Explain that to me if you know.
Well, again, it's the matter of if the people that are running those cranes just walk off, then the cranes don't get running. And although if I read correctly, the local group has already had kind of an agreement, but they still are bound by the international group. Mm-hmm. And so if the international longshoremen, go on strike, that then local people will honor that strike. And so it's just about if those, it may not be a huge number of people, but if they don't work, the ships don't get loaded and unloaded.
I was just wondering how hard.
Especially the container ships.
I was wondering
that's a big part of our local port.
How hard it would be to replace them when it comes to grain operator, not grain operator, when it comes to crane operators, how specialty of a job that is, or you don't know.
These are skilled positions these days, and they make a fairly decent salary.
Do you have any idea what the salary is?
One of the problems is that they're asking for more money. That's always what the strike is about. Mm-hmm. But they're also asking that we not basically replace these guys with AI or with machines. That's the bigger issue, that they're trying to protect their jobs. And I understand why they would do that, but that's a huge issue. The doc is not going to agree to that because, we see that every place else, that, robots are replacing people where they can, and there's reason for that. But, so trying to protect, this is historical things with unions. I like to tell my students that for 30 years, we had cabooses on trains for the sole reason of hauling the caboosemen who no longer had a job because the labor unions require that every train have, a crew of six people, one of which rides in the caboose. And so they pulled the caboose long after technology had removed the reason for the caboosemen. Uh, just, those type of inefficiencies are just really bad for the economy. Now, I understand why the workers want that, but it's a problem.
You know, I learn something every time I talk to you, Dub, and that caboose thing is new. I did not know that, but that's why I love talking to you. 7:52, we'll pick it up here when we come back. I want to talk about the nature of, from the economic standpoint, Dub, of a strike. If anybody ever wins a strike, I don't know what they do, and I always harken back to Bayou Steel and what happened there. Walter Dub Lane's our guest, associate professor of economics and finance at UNO, talking about a potential international dock workers strike, longshoremen's association strike that could affect potentially Christmas and supply chain, and we all know what a mess COVID caused with COVID. 7:52, 8 till 8. I'll get it out eventually. Tommy Tucker, traffic now, WWL. 7:58, 2 till 8. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Back to Walter Dub Lane, a friend, associate professor of economics and finance at my alma mater, UNO. I'll say it again. Clancy Dubose was the first one to say it, but UNO built the middle class of the city. Newell Norman, Diane Newman, who runs the place, myself, all graduates of UNO, and I can't thank the university enough for what they've done for me. Walter, that being said, let's talk about the economic effects of a strike. Does anybody ever really win a strike?
Well, in the short run, all the evidence says that everybody loses.
That's
because,
what I thought.
You know, the strike workers lose income while they're on strike. Now, the idea is, they're behind it is, well, then when if I get a $5,000, $10,000 raise and $5,000 raise over the next 5 years, I'll make up the money I lost. But in the short run, and then, of course, the company loses because they're shut down. They can't sell anything, and they may make it up, some of it up later. But the reason for the strikes are really twofold. Sometimes it's just psychological. The labor and management just, have this match where nobody can actually reach an agreement. But so the other one is more long-term. The idea is the only thing that workers have to bargain with is the threat of a strike. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're asking for more money, and they say, if I don't give it to you, what are you going to do? The answer is, well, the only thing they can do is strike. So sometimes they have to strike every once in a while so that maybe 4 years from now, when they bargain again and they threaten that the people will believe them, that they really will do it. If they don't think they'll ever do it, then they don't. It really reduces their bargaining power. So in the long run, workers might actually have some benefit from striking now in terms of not how much they get now, but how much it affects their bargaining power in the future.
Thank you, Dub. Appreciate your time. We'll be back talking to David Hammer about Lawrence Hecker's trial, or lack thereof.